580. It's our Morning Talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also happy to welcome back here to the program David Sinnoh. He's a clinical professor of finance at the U of I. Once a month, always on a Friday, he is on this program, and we talk about personal finance issues. The way we do this is we start out, and Dave has some comments to make. And sometimes he talks about the economy. Sometimes it might be something specific, a kind of a specific financial planning topic. And then we will take questions, and it can be on whatever it is that Dave will be talking about here at the beginning or anything else that has to do with financial planning. I know that he will do his best to help you out. So I will say to our guest, David Sinnoh, welcome back. Glad to have you here.
Well, good morning, David. And of course, it's a genuine pleasure to be with you. I'd like to spend a few moments speaking about a financial problem, which really is growing geometrically and literally affecting all of us. That problem being identity theft. And, of course, the thieves of our identities are becoming very sophisticated and extremely tech-savvy. Yesterday, for example, we learned from the Wall Street Journal that approximately 180,000 customers of the Ralph Lauren Polo stores who used credit cards to make purchases have had their credit card information stolen by hackers who broke into that particular database. And that's just one of a myriad of examples. 145,000 customer records maintained by ChoicePoint, a data storage service, were compromised in February. Some 300,000 credit card customers' records maintained by the London-based company Reed were recently compromised as well, and all of those cards apparently belong to U.S. citizens. College campuses have not even been immune to hackers. Have they found their way into several student databases, even at Northwestern and certain Ivy League schools as well? Indeed, Congress is planning to hold hearings on the matter, as estimates run as high as 10 million records of U.S. consumers are at risk of some type of identity theft in 2005. Now, of course, as individuals, we probably have very, very little control over these massive database storage facilities, but there are some steps we can take to slow down theft of our own identities before irreparable damage is really done to our credit. And once that happens, as you know, it's mighty, mighty tough to get it repaired. Hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of hours of time to get those things put back in order. So my suggestions really are pretty low tech. So I'm going to talk about the low tech side of the equation because, frankly, I'm not very high tech savvy. So first, here's my first suggestion. The next time you order checks, have only your initials and last name put on them. Do not put your first name on printed checks. Thereby, if someone takes your checkbook, they will not know how you sign your checks, whether you use your full name, your initials, or just your first name, but your bank may well know how you sign your checks, especially if you do business with a smaller community bank. Second, do not sign the back of your credit cards. All right, we get our credit cards, and what do? We immediately sign them on the back. Instead, someone pointed out that it's a lot smarter to put on the back of your card, photo ID required. Photo ID required. So don't sign David Jones or David Sinnoh. Put photo ID required. This is an excellent safety measure if your wallet is lost or stolen. Third, when you're writing checks to pay on your credit card accounts, do not, under any circumstances, put the complete account number on that check. Instead, just put the last four numbers. It's typically a 16 number anyhow, and the credit card company knows the rest of the number, and anyone who might be handling your check as it passes through all the check processing channels won't then have access to that entire account number. So change that behavior immediately. Fourth, put your work phone number on your checks instead of your home phone number if you put a phone number at all. If you have a P.O. box, use that instead of your home address. If you don't have a P.O. box, use your work address. Never, ever, ever, ever put your Social Security number on your check, especially in printed form. You can always add it if necessary. Because if you have it in printed form, anyone can get it. And if you currently have your Social Security number, and in fact, even your driver's license number printed on those checks, shred them immediately and get new ones. That is the bottom line. So you can see these suggestions that I'm making are pretty low-tech, and they really respond to the issues of a lost purse or a lost wallet, or indeed even something worse, more heinous, a stolen purse or a stolen wallet. Now, fifth, place the contents of your wallet on a photocopy machine, that's not too tough, and do both sides of each license, credit card, etc. That way you will at least know what you had in your wallet and all of the account numbers and phone numbers to call and cancel if your wallet is lost or stolen. Now, keep the photocopy in a safe place. And I also carry in my wallet a photocopy, not the original, a photocopy of my passport when I travel. And in fact, I just recently learned that if you're going to travel in and out of Canada, driver's licenses don't work anymore. Passports are going to almost entirely be insisted upon, or at least a photocopy of your passport. And we've all heard horror stories about fraud that's committed on us by stealing our names, our addresses, our Social Security numbers, our credit cards, etc. So you've got to have copies of that. By the way, for goodness sake, do not put your original of your Social Security card in your wallet. Don't carry it. All right? It's a number that you should have had memorized anyway, or you've got it somewhere else. But for goodness sake, take that little Social Security piece of paper in blue and white out of your wallet and store it in a safe place. But I want to go on with some additional critical information to limit your damage in the case it happens, in the case that your wallet or your purse, for example, are stolen. Now, we're all told that immediately we should cancel our credit cards. But the key, of course, is to have the toll-free numbers and your card numbers handy so you know who to call. So keep those where you can find them in the event your wallet is lost or stolen. Now, here are some additional things you need to do. First of all, you immediately file a police report in the jurisdiction where your credit cards, your wallet was stolen. So if you're on vacation and you get pickpocketed or something is stolen, you file a police report immediately in that particular jurisdiction, whether it's Reno, Las Vegas, San Francisco, Chicago, or Champaign-Urbana, immediately file that police report. Because this proves to credit card providers you were diligent, and this is a first step toward perhaps even a credit card investigation. But here's something far more important. First of all, you call all three national credit reporting organizations immediately, not only to tell them that your wallet and your cards and your credit has been stolen, but to place something called a fraud alert. That's the magic term, fraud alert, on your name and your Social Security number. Now, I'd never frankly heard of doing this until I was advised by a friend who works for one of the major credit card agencies and the fraud division of one of these agencies. They say you call up and you say, I need to place a fraud alert on my name and Social Security number. What this means is this alert means that any company that checks your credit, so if someone else is now going to try to use your card and it's going to go through the system, your credit knows your information was stolen, and to replace that card or use that card, you have to be contacted by phone directly to authorize new credit. And basically, that is the most important thing you can do because that effectively ends anyone using your credit cards in your name once you have posted that credit fraud alert. Now, here are the numbers you will need to contact if your wallet or your identity has been stolen. There are three national credit reporting agencies in order to post this fraud alert. The first one, Equifax. Oh, goodness, they have enough data on David Inge and David Sino probably to write a book. 1-800-525-6285. That's 1-800-525-6285. Toll free. Experian. And Experian is really E-X-P-E-R-I-A-N, Experian. That was formerly TRW. Now it's called Experian. And their phone number is 1-888-397-3742. That's the second major credit reporting agency. And the third being TransUnion. Their phone number is 1-800-680-7289. So we've got Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. And finally, after spending a lot of time, Social Security has a direct toll-free fraud line. I actually called it. Somehow I got through. All right? 1-800-269-0271. Now, additionally, all of us, including myself, have to be vigilant with respect to our emails. Remember that no financial institution that is legitimate is ever going to ask you to provide your Social Security number over the internet or other sensitive information. These innocuous-looking emails from all of these financial institutions that we receive all of the time saying that we're just checking to make sure that you aren't a victim of fraud, you're sent to a copycat website and they try to procure sensitive information. Don't even go there, just delete the email immediately. I mean, I almost got fooled one day by eBay. It looked so real to me that I started to go to it and I said, wait a second. So, I mean, even someone who is reasonably savvy can be fooled. Finally, under recently passed federal legislation, you are entitled to a free credit report annually from each of the three major credit reporting agencies, Equifax, Experian, and TransUnion. You've already got the numbers. This is by Congress, and Illinois now has met its date. So essentially, you can get a credit report annually from the three credit reporting agencies. Therefore, it seems to me it makes sense every 4 months to make a request rotating among these three credit reporting agencies. So every 4 months, you can get a free update on your credit. So you can basically stay abreast of your credit status. If you desire, however, an actual credit score, sometimes it's referred to an Empirica score, these credit agencies are authorized by law to charge you a fee if you want to actually know your actual credit score. And typically that fee is $10 to $15. But you can get that other information, which is so important, every 4 months, you get it free. Incidentally, when you request credit information on yourself, it does not impact your credit rating. It does not impact your credit score. If you've got 15 or 20 other financial institutions checking on your credit, yes, that is negative and that does impact your credit score. But when you check with one of these credit agencies yourself for information about yourself, that does not impact negatively on your credit. So there you have it, David. Gosh, a whole new financial arena on April 15th. I didn't even hardly mention that word. What is that word? Income tax, whatever that word is all about. You know, I hardly even mentioned that. No, let's worry about something else on April 15th. Credit card fraud, lost and stolen cards, you name it. Because let's hope that our listeners haven't had any negative experiences. And maybe this will help just a little bit in the event something bad happens.
All right. Very good. Well, our guest this morning is part of Focus 580, David Sinnoh. He's clinical professor of finance at the University of Illinois, and for some time now has been stopping by on a regular basis, always on a Friday, to talk about money management. Questions are welcome. We have a couple of people who are ready to go. Others, if you'd like to call, talk to Dave. The number here in Champaign-Urbana is 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that if it's a long-distance call for you, we will pay for the call, 800-222-9455. We have some callers here ready to go, and we will start with someone listening this morning in Villa Grove on our line one. Hello.
Hi, Dave. Thanks a lot for those low-tech solutions. I think I have writer's cramp already.
Okay, good morning.
That's really good info, and I copy all that stuff down. I've got a question regarding how can I determine whether it's preferable to assume a loan or sell some mutual funds to purchase some farmland?
So you're thinking about assuming a loan. Is this a loan on this farmland?
Right.
All right. Or selling some mutual funds?
Yeah.
All right.
Now, I've looked into loans, and it appears right now that the loan payments would exceed my net monthly income by over $3,000. And I'd have to sell some of my mutual funds over the next 5 years to make up for the annual shortfall of about $36,000. So it seems to me that it'd be preferable to make a lump sum payment by selling those funds and pay the maybe $10,000 or so in taxes 1 year because of the capital gains versus assuming a loan and paying over $40,000 interest over the next 5 years. So what are your thoughts regarding a loan versus selling the mutual funds for this purchase?
Well, let me ask you a couple of threshold questions. If you were to assume the loan, what percentage of that loan does it represent versus the purchase price?
What percentage of
that? In other words, is the loan that you'd be assuming on this farmland, is that 50% of your purchase price, or is it 100% of your
actually,
purchase?
Actually, 100%.
So you have the opportunity to purchase this loan with this farmland with a 100% loan.
Correct.
All right. And that, of course, would require you to have all of this massive negative cash flow because obviously the operating income would not be as high as the principal and interest payments.
Correct.
All right. And tell me just out of curiosity, at what interest rate is this loan?
6.35.
And what are the terms of the loan?
Well, that's guaranteed for 5 years.
And is this seller financing as opposed to bank financing?
No, it is not seller financing.
All right. So 6.35, 5 years, and what type of amortization schedule?
Monthly payments.
But, again, it doesn't amortize complete. Does it amortize completely over the 5 years?
Right.
Oh, so it's a very, very short-term amortization schedule,
right,
which is pretty tough. 6.35, my opinion would be, basically, I hate debt. I'm not a big believer in debt unless it really makes good sense. And certainly 100% leverage to me doesn't make any sense at all. So I'm with you. If I have a series of stocks or mutual funds that are basically not going to trigger an enormous capital gain, I would be more likely to sell those and then buy my property and enjoy my operating income and have a cash flow.
Yeah.
How do you feel about it?
Well, I feel the same way, but so many people are saying, oh, you should leverage, you should take the loan, look at the return on your investment.
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. Yeah. I don't think that's the case. I mean, we could put a pencil to it, and this is just sort of a basic overview. Can I ask you your age?
I'm nearly 70.
Well, I think at 70, why do you want to take on a lot of debt? Doesn't make any sense to me. So I think you'd be far better off enjoying a cash flow as opposed to putting $36,000 to $48,000 a year in someone else's hands.
Yeah.
And on top of that, I think that if you're buying the farmland reasonably, farmland historically has been a good investment, and there's no guarantee that your equity mutual funds are going to outperform your farmland anyway.
Yeah.
And an awful lot of people would rather have the farmland than the equity mutual funds.
Right.
So I think bottom line is, if you're in a position to do it and it's not going to be an arduous capital gain, then pay cash for the farmland or at least at least pay a substantial portion so you have deleveraged yourself. Yeah. There's always another position that you don't have to take the 100%. You could take 30-40%, so at least then you don't have a negative cash flow.
Right, yeah, but that's true. Well, good. I thought I was crazy for shelling out so much of our taxable savings, but I still have some left, so I thought, well, if it's not a problem, I can build it up again with income from the farm and other places.
I don't feel bad about that at all. Now, if you were telling me that you had a 6.35% mortgage that was a 20-year fixed mortgage, I'd feel differently about it. But basically, you're on a very short lease with a 5-year amortization, and if interest rates are moving up, you're going to pay it off anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Thanks a lot, David.
Very good.
Appreciate the information. And thanks so much for the stuff on Danny's theft.
My pleasure.
All right. Let's go next to another caller, and this person here is in Urbana, line number 2.
Yeah, hello. This is somewhat psychic because this was one of the items, the identity theft that I wanted to bring up. Actually, what's the liability? There's another problem where you don't even know that somebody has stolen your identity, and they're maybe out in California and can really, apply in whatever way they means they get. What is your liability then?
Typically, so long as you have acted prudently, once you have become aware of the situation, it typically is between $50 and $100 on a card. So the banks are the people who really have the problem, but it's not the money. It's not the money. It's the destruction of your credit. Mm-hmm. That's the problem. So while you may be able to limit your liability on a credit card to $50 or $100, when someone has run up thousands and thousands of dollars, to unwind that problem has an enormous impact on your credit. Now, if you never borrow money, if you never need money, if you don't need a bank, if you don't need credit cards or anything like that, well, then, it's not quite as bad a problem, but that's very, very few Americans, very, very few people.
It's also people who bought cars and all other
Absolutely. Kinds of-
But,
absolutely.
I don't know if you know, the newest thing is that credit card company, not credit, the your home insurance is now added protect you against it or something or other. I guess the financial part, is there a financial downside? It's like $35 a year, which that if they're not going to charge very much, there's a good chance they're not going to be paying much out, right?
Right.
Okay. What about, I'm a... either a happy or unhappy owner of a new house. I've been renting for a bit. What about the idea of liability, additional liability insurance? There tends to be, about $300,000?
Well, that's right. Typically, it's $100,000, $300,000. That's what most people have, which means that if someone is injured due to your negligence on your premises, an individual, you have insurance to the tune of $100,000 per person, $300,000 per accident. And as I continue to counsel, for anyone who has any kind of net worth, that's simply not enough.
Mm-hmm.
And typically, people even on automobiles may well have just $100,000 per person, $300,000 per accident. So you have a couple of choices. One, and that's called primary limits or primary liability. So you have a couple of choices. Choice number one is to increase your primary limits or your primary liability limits on both your homeowners and your automobile or any other property exposures that you have. Or alternatively, what most folks do is simply buy what's called an umbrella policy. It's additional liability coverage that kicks in if you exhaust your primary limits. And it's usually written with the same insurance company where you have your primary coverages. And frankly, it's dirt cheap insurance. It's often as low as $200 to $250 per million. And I think that's a very important kind of insurance to have. I'll take the small risk. I'll pay the $250. And I'll let the insurance company take the big risk, the $1 million risk.
So you would suggest possibly even at least $1 million?
Or? Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
Because what typically happens with primary limits, if, God forbid, that you find yourself in a situation of being sued in an automobile accident, the lawyer's fees alone can run up $100,000, $200,000, $300,000 without any claim or any injury relief for the actual plaintiff. So that's the problem. that typically the legal fees can be so arduous that it can run right up to policy limits and you're not covered. That's one of the major reasons to have umbrella, because it covers the lawyer's fees and it also covers, obviously, injuries to any aggrieved party.
And the final one is, what's your reaction to, I guess, the legislation is headed, the one in terms of bankruptcy? For the credit card companies, it actually favors the credit card companies.
It certainly does. I mean, I think what you're reading is that anyone who is not very well off to begin with is going to suffer more under this particular type of legislation. There are a number of articles that appeared in the Wall Street Journal, I think, in the last week that this legislation could impact tremendously on divorced moms and non-working spouses who are relying on essentially alimony payments and maintenance payments, which now may be at risk if that particular other party declares bankruptcy, that those dollars can now be seized by the credit card companies. So no question that this is not a it's not a victory for consumers.
Mm-hmm.
It's certainly a victory for credit card companies, and let's face it, credit card companies want to be paid, and it makes it easier, frankly, to go after people who find themselves in difficult circumstances.
Also,
so I'm not very crazy about this particular piece of legislation.
They create the problem, too, by these multiple offers and, you know, whatever.
Well, that's right. I mean, it really is disgusting when all of us, including our kids, are receiving these offers. There isn't a week that goes by. I would just love to have the postage that goes out by the credit card companies, you know, put that all in a great big barrel and see how many millions and hundreds of millions of dollars just in postage in soliciting us to have another credit card. And every time that we have a credit card, even if we don't use the credit card, that impacts our credit score. Most people don't understand that. I teach this at the University of Illinois. I'm amazed at the seniors at the U of I in my finance class, the number of credit cards they have. They maybe have 8 or 10 different credit cards, and they said, well, we don't use them. It doesn't matter because each of them carries a line of credit. So when it comes to your credit score, it negatively impacts the more credit that you actually have access to as a result of all of these credit cards. So it's another good reason not to carry a lot of credit cards.
Thank you very much.
All right. My pleasure.
Thank you for the call. A little bit past the midpoint here. Again, our guest is Dave Sinnoh. He's a clinical professor of finance at University of Illinois. Once a month on a Friday, he's here on the program. We talk about money management, personal finance issues. And if you have a question, obviously we want you to think very carefully, do a lot of research, do your homework before you make any decision. This is one piece of the puzzle. If you're looking for a little advice, I know Dave will help you out and give you his opinion. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We go on to another Urbana caller. This is line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm. Good morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
And Mr. Sinnoh, I tuned in just a little late, and I started writing furiously, but I missed one of those phrases that you mentioned, what to say to the
credit reporting organizations. You want to place what's called a fraud alert.
A fraud alert. Okay.
Fraud alert on your name, both your name and your Social Security number.
Okay.
That's the key.
That's all I needed to know. And this is a great show. Thanks very much for putting up with us.
Thank you for the call. Let's go on here to listener in Terre Haute, line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
My question is, the dollar way back when was $20 an ounce, and you could exchange the dollars for gold. Then the Depression came along and went to 35, and then after that they went to, I think foreigners could still redeem at 35, and domestically you could redeem at 70 or something like that, if I remember right. And then they floated the dollar. So it's not redeemable in gold anymore, right?
That's correct. We went off the gold standard many, many, many years ago.
Okay, so what's all the gold at Fort Knox doing now? What's it for?
Sitting, gathering dust. You know, I haven't thought about it economically, why we still have that particular gold. I need an economist to call in. You just stumped me. I really haven't given it any thought, and I don't have any good response to it. What I think is the most interesting part about the gold are all the people who didn't turn in their gold when it was called in, when we went off the gold standard. And all of those gold coins, those numismatic gold coins, have just escalated dramatically in value. But I don't have a good answer for you. So we need an economist to call in and give you that answer. And what I will do is I've written that question down. So if no economist calls in, then I will talk to two or three over in the economics department and say, what are we doing with all of that gold in Fort Knox? And is it simply a psychological type of impact that we have on our currency and on the financial viability of our system? Or is there some really good reason to have it? So I just don't know.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, thank you. So what do you get for an ounce of gold these days?
Well, you're in the 400s, David.
Huh.
You're in the 400s. Now, in the olden days, which were, I think, about the 1980s, gold really went up to about $800.
Yeah,
that's right, 800. So people who were buying at 5, 6, 7, and 8, the gold bugs, well, they haven't been very, very happy. But then gold dipped down into the 200s, 250, and now we're back above 400. So that's what an ounce of gold brings today.
Okay, let's go on here. Next caller is in Urbana, line 1.
Hello.
Yes.
Would you please give me the phone numbers again for Equifax and Experian and TransUnion?
Sure, be happy to. Equifax is 1-800-525-6285.
6285, okay.
And Experian is 1-888-888-397-3742. And TransUnion is 1-800-680-7289.
7289. Okay, 1-800-525-6285. 1-888-397-3742. 1-800-680-7289.
Yes.
Thank you very much.
All right. Thank you. And I know obviously not everyone has internet access, but all of these three have websites.
So absolutely.
If you want to get that information or other information about them, you can always do it through the internet. Can you request your credit report over the internet, or would you say you wouldn't want to do that because what you've got to do is give them your Social Security number and your personal information?
You know, I'm old fashioned, David. I always
call. You like to use the phone?
I have to laugh. For my daughters, they actually use Telefile, all right, as opposed to e-file for their tax return. So they actually, I said, well, you know, use the telephone as opposed to the e-file. So I'm sort of old-fashioned. But, yes, you can even do a Google search. You can find the websites, and then you can request it.
You do that one.
Yes.
Okay. Very good. The next caller is in Indiana on line 2. Hello.
Hello. Yep. Actually, just for comment on this recent thing, there's a website you can go to. I think it's freeannualreport or annualreport.com. I've already done it, and I've forgotten what it was already. But they give you all three, and you just check on them, and they go through procedure identifying you. Then you can print it out. I discovered that Equifax had the most information on me. It was up to date, and I tried to do another one, and they had addresses from 1988 and 89 as where I was living, and so I didn't go ahead with the procedure for that because it put out a lot of pages on me. The original one did, Equifax, so I've just used that, and then I'm going to go back do the other two at, you know, my leisure, because it turned into a hellish situation on the net to give all the information. They were asking for old, credit card numbers that I don't even use anymore, which surprised me. I thought they were all, you know, essentially up to date. But
well, that's what's so interesting about the credit reporting agencies. Remember that while they share major databases, they are also independently gathering information, and that's why it's so important eventually to look at all of this stuff and see what they have.
Yeah, I certainly agree to that. Now, what I wanted to bring up, I hope it's within your purview, or at least you might make a comment, is three things have happened with my bank or banking that's concerned me. The first thing was a number of months ago, I received a handwritten letter from another bank from a lady asking me to, you know, change over to their checking and savings, etc. And I couldn't understand how she pulled that off, because my bank has a privacy situation where they don't hand out that information, they said. So I jumped on them, and I found out, the lady I talked to talked to somebody in the other bank, found out that they were going through checks that came to their bank and getting local addresses and trying to, get business from them. Then I was told if I wanted to carry this any further, I could do it, up the chain of command, sort of back, in the banking world and make, some nasty remarks and stuff would go on their record. But the bank wouldn't do it for them. It was all up to me. I had to prove it and had to have copies of everything. So I ended up yelling at the other bank, and they were, very supplicative and everything, said they were sorry, would never do it again. But,
Now, did they admit that this was the process that they were using?
Yes.
Okay. And I frankly don't know the legality of that process.
It was
maybe
not legal.
It's what?
It was not legal, but it was sort of like a quasi thing. You had to do a lot of stuff to prove intent and over a period of time. And you might as well forget about that if you
well,
don't
have
right.
the
money.
That's right.
So
you could spend thousands trying to fight that.
I forgot about it. And I guess the woman who has this rather progressive view of getting new customers for the bank was slapped on the knuckles, but she's still running the show. Now, secondly, I received a rather nice form letter and a pamphlet and everything from the same bank that was trying to get my business some time ago, and they stated in the letter that they got our general sense, got your information from exchanging of bank information among banks, to help themselves get new customers. And I looked into that. It turned out to be about the same situation, but it was a little more 50-50, and I didn't carry that through either. But the third thing that happened to me last week sort of got me going is that I received a letter from my bank. Congratulations. You now have, bank protection or something like that, where every customer had a checking account, was given $300 backup on their account in case they overdrew. Okay. Of course, there's a charge for that.
Yes.
And I called in. I said, I got enough trouble just keeping care of my own money. I don't want to have another $300 show. It shows up as your balance.
That's right.
And it's not, there's no arrows pointed to it or anything. And I started thinking, not only me, but little old lady's going to get trapped in this thing because it just seems like a thing built to get you to, I don't have to worry. And all of a sudden you've got some nice fees that you never had before.
Well, that's right. And if you overdraw, the fees are huge.
What bothers me is that it's a blanket thing. No one ever wrote me a letter and made me fill out a form if I wanted it. I had to go down to the bank and sign some forms to waive
that you
it.
Didn't want it.
Yeah,
right.
And that really upsets me about American banking. I mean, that's the only banking system I know about, but I just sort of wonder, where their fingers are all going now. It's just something that bothered me, and I thought I'd bring it up to you. And I don't know if it's in your purview or something you have a view on or what, but it sure as hell excited me.
Well, it would excite you, and
thanks a lot.
It tells you that there is just enormous competition among banks. I mean, let's face it, we are a very sound financial system in the United States. Everybody looks to us in spite of the value of our dollar. It's of high integrity, and these things do bother you. And what it really is very aggressive marketing and searching out areas for new fees because of the difficulty of really making substantial amounts of money by loaning money any longer, and that many, many banks are looking for alternative sources of fees, whether it's trust income, whether it's checking income, whether it's credit card income, wherever that they can find it. And this is one more place. And at the same time, occasionally this may do some good for someone who periodically overdraws their account. But what's unfortunate about it is that the default suggestion should be, gee, if you'd like this, we'll be happy to send you a form so you can add it, as opposed to the other way around. You now have it, and if you want to get rid of it, you've got to come in and sign some forms. So that tells you that we're doing some very aggressive marketing at that particular institution. And sure, I would be upset about it also. And thanks for bringing those items to our attention.
Yeah, very good. All right. Well, we'll just continue to take calls here. We have a number of people. We'll try to get in as many as we can in the time that remains, which is about 15 minutes. The next is someone here in Urbana, and I believe that would be line number 3. Hello. They're called there, line 3 in Urbana. Well, let's go to we have somebody
good
on.
Good morning.
Oh, yes, go ahead.
Good morning.
Yes.
Hi. I have a question. I'd like to get your feeling about taking a home equity loan and reinvesting that in some relatively safe thing that might yield a greater return, like an investment-grade life insurance or something else. Is that a good idea, a sound idea?
No. That's my opinion.
Okay.
I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think it makes any sense to take an equity loan because typically equity loans are adjustable loans. They're not fixed interest rate loans. They move with the direction of interest rates. If you feel as I do that interest rates are still going to move up higher, you're borrowing money at maybe 6, 6.5, 7, whatever, unless you have a teaser rate. And then you're looking for something relatively safe. If you can tell me something relatively safe or safe that will pay that level of interest that you are borrowing money at, I'd sure like to hear about it because I don't know of any investments quite like that. There
okay.
just aren't any sure things. And the last thing I would do is take that money and purchase life insurance with it. I don't think that makes any sense at all. So I think you have to have a better reason for taking an equity loan out of a personal residence.
Okay. Apparently a friend of mine has read a book and gone to a seminar and seems to have bought the idea that this is a good idea. I don't know who's selling it, but I wanted to check that with someone else. All right. Thank you very much.
All right. My pleasure. Thank you. Next, we'll talk with someone on a cell phone on our line 4.
Okay. I'll be very brief here. Number one, first of all, credit reports are also at the hands of prospective employers.
Absolutely.
One has to be careful when applying for a job. I've been asked that questions whether they regard divorce, bankruptcy, and they'll also state that we will check your credit report. So people have to be careful about that. And then my second, that was a comment. My question is, if I have several credit cards that I am not using currently, do I write to the company and say that I have no balance on them, I'd like them to be removed from my report?
Well, actually, you have to cancel the credit card. That is the only way that you can have this done, is you must actually cancel the credit card. Because as long as you have the credit card, as long as it is current, even with zero balance, it will have a negative impact on your credit score.
Okay, and that's with the company then.
Right. And also something else, you made a very important point that when you are applying for a position with a particular company, that company, more often than not, now wants to check your credit. But they have to notify you of that, and typically you sign off and you authorize them to check your credit.
Very good. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
All right. Very good. On we go. And the next up will be line number 2. And this is, on second thought, let's do line number 3 in Urbana. Hello.
Was that line number 3?
Yes.
Oh, thank you. Just a quick question then, David. I'm wondering what the point is of not having your full name on your checks when it's already there in your wallet on your driver's license and your signature's there and it's on your credit card. And I didn't quite get the point.
Well, checks may not be carried at the same time with your wallet. That's number one.
Oh.
And number two, by not having your full name on your checks, then if your checkbook is stolen separately, for example, it is a little bit more difficult to figure out what the signature is required on the check to make the check valid.
Okay. The other question I have, my son just had an identity alert from University of California at Berkeley.
Yes, that was one of the ones that were written up in the journal.
Yes, and so I've been dealing with that. Because he's overseas.
And tell us a little bit about that. I'd be interested. What's going on with that?
Well, they just sent a letter saying that on March 11th, a computer was stolen from the graduate division and that his name and Social Security were on, he was among those on it. And they told you what to do. They gave you the 3 agencies that you've given.
Yes.
To put a fraud alert on them. That was basically the suggestion.
Good.
But you can't do that when you're overseas, of course, because you can't get to those agencies with an 800 number.
Well, that's right.
So I then had to get to someone else, and there's a special email that gives you an email number so that they can do it by email from overseas. to report to the credit agency that they want the fraud alert on. But one of the things she told me was that it was sufficient just to contact one of the agencies, which is, I wondered about that. You definitely said all three.
Well, I would suggest calling all three. I don't like to leave anything to chance. Mm-hmm. Now, remember that these credit agencies do share information. There
yes.
are all kinds of national data banks that share information. But earlier in the program, if you'll recall, there was a gentleman who called in and said that he checked with Equifax
yes.
and had a pretty complete report. Then he checked with one of the other organizations, and they had things that were out of whack, old databases, old credit cards. So to me, I don't leave things to chance.
Yes.
I would much rather make certain that I've got a live person, a real person I've talked to, who has my fraud alert.
And the other thing that Berkeley University of California did, they have an 800 number to deal with this problem.
Mm-hmm.
They have separate stationery that's printed with ID alert
mm-hmm.
coming from Sproul Hall.
They're taking it seriously, aren't they?
Yes, so I imagine it covers a rather large quantity of people. She also said so far they had no reports of anyone having their identity theft stolen.
Well, that's the positive part. Just because the computer is stolen or someone hacks into the database, typically what they found out statistically is a very, very tiny number of identities are actually stolen or hacked into and dealt with.
Right. Well, this was the computer that was stolen.
Yeah. That's a whole different sort of issue.
And it says something a little strange that an individual not yet identified.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I didn't know what that implied, whether it was internal theft or...
Well, it brings up a whole list and litany of legal issues. For example, was Berkeley, for example, negligent to begin with in allowing someone access and being able to steal a computer? That's a tough question. That's sort of a threshold question. And then even if Berkeley was negligent and someone was harmed, is the University of California at Berkeley a suable entity for purposes of repaying the aggrieved party just to get their credit straightened out? So there's a whole litany of issues, but it sounds like most universities, obviously, even the University of Illinois, is relooking at this very issue. I was reading just yesterday in some basic literature at Champaign-Urbana that this whole thing is being looked at very, very carefully. It's a tough area. It's a tough problem, and it's just going to grow. But thank you so much for sharing that.
Very good, and thank you. And let's try to get in line number one in Urbana. Hello.
Hi. Modern portfolio theory. What do you think about that?
I think it's excellent. I think it's excellent. What it teaches you is that it pays to diversify among different asset classes. I teach it at the University of Illinois. It's not an end-all, be-all, but for most folks, it teaches you that diversification pays off. And effective diversification reduces the volatility of a portfolio.
Yes. Well, then according to that theory, I heard that it was broken down into 18-year time periods, like 30 to 48, 1930 to 48, that the market was the same. And then the next 18 years, it jumped 1,000 points. Then the next 18 years, it was the same. Then the next 18 years, it jumped 1,000 points. So according, if history repeats itself or at least rhymes with itself, they say that the next about 18-year period will be about same, a sideways market?
Well, I don't want to go there. That's just speculation. But what I do think is important for all of us to remember, mm-hmm. and this really is a segue to the very issues you're raising, is if you are going to be an investor in equities and you're going to be well diversified, you must be a long-term investor, because it is absolutely true that you could find, for example, a 20-year period where you would have been better off investing in certificates of deposit down at the local bank than owning a diversified portfolio of stocks.
Oh my goodness.
But if you are a legacy investor, if you are an investor for life, you cannot find a consecutive period of time in U.S. history, when I'm talking now 25 to 30 years, that's what I'm talking about, not 8, 6, 10, where you wouldn't have been better off in a properly diversified portfolio of equities than even the best fixed income.
So
if you're going to be a stock market investor, you must think long, long term.
So longer than even going to college for your kids.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Oh, my goodness. Do you think the IPSOM Ipsum chart is fraudulent?
The Ipsum chart?
Yes.
Is fraudulent?
Do you think it represents, the growth of stocks, et cetera, fraudulent?
Are you talking about Ibbotson?
Maybe.
Ibbotson?
The
graph of Ibbotson stocks and bonds? Mm-hmm. No, it's some of the most respected academic and intellectual research that's ever been produced. So absolutely not. On the contrary. It's some of the best databases and data series that we have access to. Hello?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Modern Portfolio Theory, they had the chart of the Japan market and how it's been down now for so terribly long, and then the American market just mirroring that only about 10 years or so later in time. Mm-hmm. Do you think that we're headed for something that happened to Japan?
No, and I really just don't. I'm not into the predicting business. What I would say, however, is that modern portfolio theory would suggest to us that not only do we own asset classes in the U.S., but we own asset classes internationally. So, for example, just this year, while the Dow Jones is down 4 or 5% for the year, Dow Jones in Europe, for example, the big Europe stocks, they're up 4 or 5%. And that's what modern portfolio theory teaches us. You don't want everything behaving in the same direction all of the time. So that way you reduce portfolio volatility. Great questions, and thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. Well, there, we're going to have to wrap it up for this time around with our thanks to our guest, David Sinnoh. He's a clinical professor of finance at the U of I. He's with us every month, always on a Friday, and we do these programs. We appreciate you being here.
Thanks so much for inviting me.
The program, Focus 580, is made possible in part with support from the Art Mart in the Lincoln Square Mall, Urbana. The Art Mart is pleased to support public radio in East Central Illinois. The broadcast also is made possible with support from Owens Funeral Home at the corner of Elm and University in Champaign, locally owned and operated and serving families since 1925. Owens Funeral Home invites you to join them in supporting public radio. A little bit later today on the Afternoon Magazine, we'll take a look at Ben Franklin's life in France. He spent 8 years there, and biographer Stacy Schiff says that those years should be considered his crowning achievement. Her new book is titled A Great Improvisation, Franklin, France, and the Birth of America, and she will be talking with Celeste Quinn in the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today, a little bit later on. Today in the second hour of this show, hour number 2, our guest is Jeffrey Stone. He's professor of law at the University of Chicago, and we will be talking about his book Perilous Times, which takes a look at 6 points in American history when there was an attempt by the government to restrict civil liberties. Very specifically here, we're talking about First Amendment, freedom of speech. He's here visiting the campus. We'll talk with him in a little bit. First, though, we'll take a break for news and update on the markets. Please stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
Good morning, everyone. This is Dave Dickey with a look at the markets. Corn futures are trading steady to lower in light dealings midway through today's session on the Chicago Board of Trade. Prices drifting into negative terrain on what has been viewed.